Hello and a big welcome from Holden Village. Today is June 22nd, and this morning, it's June 22nd, the year 2000, by the way. And this morning, for our Bible study, we will continue with Rabbi Robert Marks, and his session is Clear Away in the Wilderness, Dealing with Some of the Thorny Texts of the Bible. And this is tape number MXR 2000-3. Now let's join Rabbi Marks with his presentation this morning.
You had a pleasant night's sleep, and on this cool morning after the longest day of the year, do you realize that yesterday was the longest day of the year?
Yeah.
It was indeed the longest day of the year,
and the first day of summer.
And today is the first day of summer, and it is good to see you all at this historic turning point. And let us make it a historic turning point by the way we study, by the quality of our study today. I want to deal with the question of brothers. It is amazing, absolutely amazing, how much space in the first five books of Moses, or better yet, in the first book of the five books of Moses, in the book of Genesis, how much space the conflict of brothers occupies. It is a recurring theme. And I would like to deal with it today in terms of the question which begins the brother's story, and the answer which ends it. The question is where? Where? And the answer is here. The question is, where is your brother? And what does it mean to be a brother? And the answer, in a sense, which we will discover, I hope, at the end of this hour, is here. Here. And I mean here. Where? Cain and Abel. Two brothers. The first two brothers. Amazing that at the very, very beginning of the whole story of civilization, there should be an act of violent relationship between two brothers. And the answer is why? Why did they do that? I'm going to ask you to read just a little bit of that story of the two brothers, and then somebody is going to try and tell me, and you probably will not be successful, I must warn you, in telling me why. Okay? Will you turn, please, to chapter 4 of Genesis? Somebody start to read verse 1, if you will, please. You'll need your Bibles for today. Okay? Every day. The Bible's a good thing to have around, right? Don't you think? Okay, good one. Okay. Somebody start reading chapter 4, please.
Now the man knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have produced a man with the help of the Lord. Next she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a tiller of the ground. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground. And Abel, for his part, brought the firstlings of his flock, their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. The Lord said to Cain, Why are you angry, and why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is lurking at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it. Cain said to his brother.
If you can stop for just a moment, I think that's such a key passage, and it's a very, very difficult passage to understand. Sin crouches at the door, and unto thee is its desire. That's a powerful sentence. If you stopped it, you know, you could give a whole sermon on that one. I'm sure a lot of clergy people here today, I'm sure you've given a sermon, or have you? Maybe you haven't. I never have, but I love the passage. I mean, I just feel sin crouches at the door, and its desire is for you. What does it mean? Somebody explain what you think that passage means. Sin croucheth at the door, and its desire is for you. Boy, that sounds like it ought to be a movie almost, doesn't it? You know, one of these film noirs, there's sin crouching there. You know, Ingmar Bergman film, right? Sin crouching at the door. He would be personified, probably a woman. No, a thin man, that's what he would be. Very thin. I don't qualify for that role. What does it mean? How do you see it?
The sacrifice of the wicked is
detained. No, don't read your don't read your commentaries. Let's hear you. I want to hear you, because the commentaries will answer it for everybody. And you know, that'll spoil all the fun for everybody else. They'll listen to the commentaries. Yeah. What do you think it means, though?
Temptation.
Okay.
Well, I guess I see it where it says, if you do not do well, it seems to me then one can begin feeling guilty about not doing well. And if you start feeling guilty about not doing well, then you start trying to justify it, and self-pity gets in there. You start feeling sorry for yourself, and that justifies all kinds of evil against whoever.
All right. Very good. That's one. What else? What else? You know, you don't need to be a preacher to just put your oar in these waters.
Just the choices that we have.
Good.
Do we go through the door, or do we not go through the door? Uh-huh. Who's in charge here?
Who's in charge here, huh?
Makes it sound as if sin has a mind of its own.
It does, doesn't it?
It puts a volition and an intentionality to sin as if it were a persona.
And we don't think of it that way usually, do we? That sin is, but if you stop to think about it, isn't that a profound thought, and a rather disturbing thought, that there are things there, that it's not that we necessarily have a desire or a weakness, but that weaknesses come into our lives. I think that's sort of a very scary thing, and it's true. There are moments that we turn the corner and see opportunities. I think of how virtuous I was. Now, I talked yesterday about how I had stolen Warren's popcorn by asking him to look up to the mountains. those of you who just arrived yesterday, I've got to, you know, it's just, I wanted a handful of popcorn, and the director of our camp was walking past, and I, you know, encouraged two people to say to him, look, quoting Psalm 120, lift up thine eyes unto the mountains, and I grabbed a handful of popcorn, and I said, from whence cometh my help, which is the last part of that verse. So, but I must tell you, so I repented of that yesterday. But today I must tell you that I got one of these silly questionnaires in the mail, Sin Crouches at the Door, and they sent me $1 for answering the questionnaire. Now, this is the best thing I've done in a week. Okay. I put the dollar back in the envelope and sent it back without the questionnaire. Wasn't that noble of me? A dollar bill. The question is, ladies and gentlemen, suppose it had been a $100 bill or a $1,000 bill. What would you have done? You know, you probably would have answered the questionnaire. Sin croucheth at the door. There are so many, many opportunities that are not related necessarily to our own weaknesses, but that come in, but maybe they are related to our own weaknesses. So maybe ultimately that's what we have to deal with. Now, let's continue the story of Cain and Abel, please. Go ahead. You read it.
Cain said to his brother Abel, let us go out to the field. Excuse me. And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" He said, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" And the Lord said, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground. And now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it will no longer yield to you its strength. You will be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth." Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. Today you have driven me away from the soil, and I shall be hidden from your face. I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth, and anyone who meets me may kill me." Then the Lord said to him, "Not so. Whoever kills Cain will suffer a sevenfold vengeance." And the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who came upon him would kill him. Then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord.
That's it. Cain went away from the presence of the Lord. Very powerful. If you stop to think of it, it's very powerful. This is, and the question is, where? What is the mark of Cain? How do you usually, in your church services, how do you usually translate that or understand the mark of Cain? What is the mark of Cain? What is it? How do you translate? How do you understand it? You've heard this story before 1,000 times, haven't you? All right. So what is the mark of Cain? Or do you just sort of pass over that? You preacher people. You just sort of say, "I don't understand it exactly, so let's just go on to the next verse."
I think most people interpret it exactly the opposite of what I read in Scripture, and that is that most people see it as some kind of a curse, and whereas in actual fact it seems to be a protection.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Most people see it as a curse, the mark of Cain, don't they?
Yeah.
They say it's the mark of Cain. It's actually sort of an anti-capital punishment thing.
Yeah.
If you stop to think about it, you know, Cain has his own curse on him, but he's not killed in retaliation for what he's done, and let nobody kill him, right? What else do you see? How else have you heard this dealt with?
I have another thought, and that is that if he goes away from the presence of the Lord, in the presence of the Lord we have peace and harmony, or we have relationship. Away from the presence of the Lord is isolation. So not only does he get the mark that may preserve his life here, but he's isolated.
Mm-hmm. Okay, he gets the mark, he's isolated, very good. You know, somebody used to say to me in these discussions, there are no wrong answers, because you're dealing with interpretation. So it's interesting for me to hear the various... You look like you want to say something, I can tell, but... No, you don't? No. Okay, the look on your face. Okay? Good.
May I offer a question for my 10-year-old?
Yes.
Why does he kill his brother anyway?
That is a 12-year-old question, not an 11-year-old.
He has a little brother, so he may have some reason.
Well, this
he's bigger than him.
It's a very good question. Why does he kill him in the first place? But first of all, let's ask a preceding question.
I know the preceding question's always bothered me about this story.
What's that?
Why did God not find favor with Cain?
Aha, that's the preceding question. That is the preceding question, and the answer to that question may give us the answer to the 13-year-old's question. Okay. Now, what is the answer to that question? Why did God favor... Why did God favor Abel's offering over Cain's offering? First of all, let's ask the question, what was the difference between the two? What were they? Let's understand that clearly in mind. Now you have to look back in your Bibles, huh? Okay, what was Cain's offering? What was Abel's offering? Yes.
Abel's offering was the first of the flock, or first of...
Of his flock, right. The firstlings of his flock. And what was Cain's offering?
It was just part of the crop.
Part of his crop, okay. You're a preacher.
No, I'm not.
You're not. Okay, you're a student. Okay. So why, and you know, the question is, why was Abel's offering, boy, this is exciting, isn't it? Why was Abel's offering more acceptable than Cain's? And you've given the answer, whether you realize it or not. You've given, when I say you've given the answer, I'm going to also say there's no answer, right? There's no, perhaps there's no real reason for it. That's one answer. But you've given another answer. You've given the traditional answer, the one my commentary, my Chumash, will tell me is the answer. You've given it to me already. You don't know you've given it to me, but you've given it to me. Okay, you've given, see?
What? It's the first.
Abel just brought the fruits of the field. Cain brought
the firstlings.
I'm sorry. Turn it around. Cain brought the fruits of the field. Abel brought the firstling, the choicest, in other words, the very best. Now that's one answer, but I gotta tell you, the other answer is we don't know. We don't know. Yes.
Could it have anything to do with a living sacrifice?
Well, there are later commentaries that say that it was you know, and later on, when this was a comment, this was an answer that would be comment in the first century BCE. You know, when you offered sacrifices at the temple. Mm-hmm. And the priest at the temple would say, well, it was Abel that was favored because he brought a living sacrifice, whereas, which, you know, the Pharisees, I must tell you, Pharisees hated the Sadducees as much as the New Testament, in terms of Matthew and Mark, seemed to hate the Pharisees. And I'm not going to get into this, but I say in the New Testament, the Pharisees and the Sadducees get mistaken for one another, which is confusing to people, I know. The Pharisees did not like the priests in the temple. They were trying to do away with the priesthood for various other reasons than political. They felt it was outmoded. Sacrifices were passé in the first century and the era between 100 BC and 100 CE. They were trying to do away with these temple sacrifices, with the temple bureaucracy, with a very highly paid structure of priesthood. And the priests would justify this, who were, you know, the dominant power structure around 100 BCE, would justify this by saying that Abel brought a living sacrifice, whereas Cain brought a lesser sacrifice, merely an agricultural one. See, they would have said that then. That won't wash today very well. Okay, because it... But one could say, too, it was a very arbitrary act on the part of God, that God favored one or the other. Does God have to explain to me who he favors? I mean, why is Bill Gates Bill Gates, okay? I don't know. I ask God why he did that. Now, why? Let's get back to the 14-year-old question. Why did Cain kill Abel? Yeah. Was that your question? Why did Cain kill Abel? Why do you think? Why do you think? Give me a reason. You tell me.
Mm-hmm.
Because? Yeah. Well, you have a brother, right?
Yes.
Do you always get along perfectly?
No.
Maybe you didn't get along with him. Is that possible?
Yes.
But that's no reason to kill him, right?
Yes, always.
No reason to kill him. You're absolutely right. There's no. Why did he kill him? Well, the traditional answer is he was jealous of him, right? Mm-hmm. That's the traditional. He was jealous of his brother. You ever get jealous of your brother?
No.
No, okay. Does he ever get jealous of you?
Yes.
Yes, okay. So maybe you ought to be a little afraid.
That's why he asked the question.
Well, I'm going to protect you. Okay, come on. You have nothing to worry about. But so the answer, the traditional answer is that Cain was jealous of his brother. But what if there, somebody earlier today suggested a brilliant other answer too. What if Cain was angry at God, not at Abel? Angry at God for the way Abel had been favored over. For what?
To take away what God favored.
Right, right. What if it was really a deicide, that he was killing God, in a sense, not killing his brother? Something to think about, at least.
If there is no Abel, perhaps I will be closer to God.
And that's another good answer, yeah. Without Abel, I'll have daddy's favor. Daddy, mother. You know? I'll be the favorite. I'll be the favorite one. Well, now this feeling of being favored is a very, very prominent idea. I'm going to ask you now to turn to another brother conflict. Let us turn, please, in our Bibles to Genesis 25. Verse 19, Genesis 25, verse 19. 25, verse 19. Will somebody read a little bit, please?
This is the genealogy of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begot Isaac. Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah as wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban, the seer, Syrian. Now Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife, because she was barren, and the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. But the children struggled together within her, and she said, "If all is well, why am I like this?" So she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb. Two people shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger."
Now, I've got to interrupt now, but you're going to read some more in just a minute, all right? I want to tell you that there is a very important idea to be found here that affects Jewish history, that has to be understood by everybody if we're to understand how this Bible got interpreted, both for Jews and for Christians. The assumption of the Bible is that it is through Jacob that the nation and that the people will persist. That is clear right here, that the younger shall dominate the older, or the older shall serve the younger, is clear. Now the older is going to be Esau, which we're going to deal with in just a minute. The younger is going to be Jacob. It is the younger one who will be the triumphant one. And I've said something just now, that the younger one will be the triumphant one. Does that Does that ring a bell anywhere? I mean, just make some analogies now. Let's connect your own knowledge of the Bible with what I've just, with the sentence I've just offered.
And the last shall be first.
The last shall be first? Where's that? Where do you see that? Where? Quote, where, the source.
Somewhere in the New Testament.
Okay. Okay. New Testament. All right. What else do you think of? Give me some parallels.
Joseph.
Joseph and his brothers. It is the younger brother. In Joseph's case, the youngest, until Benjamin comes along. The youngest that is the favorite. Well, what about the story you just read? Who was born first? Cain was born first. Notice how the theme of the younger brother occurs over and over again. The younger brother tends to be the more dominant brother in this process. Very interesting to me. Now, the second thing is this. It is the younger brother in each case that is going to be, in each surviving case, let me put it. It's hard for Abel to be the progenitor of people. But in these two cases, it is the younger brother that seemingly assumes the leadership role. Jacob and Joseph. Joseph certainly becomes the leader of his brothers. Joseph is responsible, after all, for two of the 12 tribes. Now, how he does this is sort of wonderful, because his children, Manasseh and Ephraim, are the names of the tribes, whereas the rest are Jacob's children. But it is Jacob who's going to dominate. I want you to know right from the beginning that in the Jewish tradition, Esau becomes a synonym. And it's important, a synonym for something else. And it's important to know what that is. Esau becomes a synonym for Rome. For Rome. Now, why? Why does Esau become a synonym for Rome? Rome and Jerusalem, I don't need to tell a Lutheran audience, Episcopalian, Methodist, a whole bunch of us here of different things, why Rome was the enemy. You know the whole history of Israel from 50 BCE till way into the 4th century was dominated by Rome. You also know that Rome and Jerusalem were bitter foes. You also know that Jesus was born at a time when the Romans ruled Jerusalem. You also know the Jews looked for a Messiah who would free them, a political Messiah, not a spiritual Messiah. That's where Judaism and Christianity differ in very significant ways. It was a spiritual Messiah that became the expression of Christianity. But in the first century, it was a political Messiah. And Messiah meant political. It meant political leadership. It meant a descendant of King David. Do you know what Messiah is? In actual definition, Messiah simply means anointed. A Messiah is an anointed one. David was a Mashiach, an anointed one. Saul, the first king, was anointed by Samuel, king of Israel. Solomon was anointed. The king was anointed. David was the master king of Israel. So the Mashiach, the Messiah, would be a Mashiach ben David, a Messiah descended from David, one who would appear. One who would appear at Passover time to liberate the people. One who would appear at a time of suffering, a political suffering. One whose appearance was made all the more desirable because of political suffering. And political suffering in Roman times for Jews was intense because of their refusal to worship the Roman emperor, the Caesars. So Jews yearned for a Messiah. Jews could not say Rome was our enemy because there are countless stories in the Midrash and the Agada that I talked about yesterday, countless stories about how Jews who sought to express any sort of an independent thought would find themselves crucified, a favorite form of Roman execution. So how did you do it? You develop pseudonyms. You developed names. And Esau became the name synonymous with Rome. Esau and Esau's kingdom, which later became Edom. So Edom or Esau, they're used interchangeably in the literature. Esau did this, and you would describe the wicked things Esau did. He becomes much more wicked in the tradition. This by way of explaining what I have to say now. Became much more wicked in the tradition than he was in the Bible. So the Midrash then attributes things, and you'll see, read on a little bit more, and I'll show you how this works.
So when her days were fulfilled for her to give birth, indeed there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red. He was like a hairy garment all over, so they called his name Esau. Afterward, his brother came out, and his hands took hold of Esau's heels. So his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. So the boys grew, and Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field. But Jacob was a mild man, dwelling in tents. And Isaac loved Esau because he hated his game. But Rebekah loved Jacob. Now Jacob cooked a stew when Esau came in from the field, and he was weary. And Esau said to Jacob, "Please feed me with that same red stew, for I am weary." Therefore, his name was called Edom. But Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright as of this day." And Esau said, "Look, I am about to die, so what is this birthright to me?" Then Jacob said, "Swear to me as of this day." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. And Jacob gave Esau bread and stew of lentils. Then he ate and drank, arose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright.
Okay, stop now. Let's hear a little thing. What is your characterization now of these two people? How do you feel about them? Jacob, you've been introduced to Jacob and Esau. How do you feel?
Esau didn't have much respect for his position at that point, anyway.
Okay. Esau had no respect for his position. What else?
Esau was weak.
Esau was weak. In what way? Well, you don't mean physically, do you?
No.
He was a field and stream man. I mean, went out hunting and fishing and stuff like that.
He was a daddy's boy.
Esau was a daddy's boy, right? Yes, you know that later on. How do you know that from this, though? You've read your Bible. You've read ahead. I know you've read ahead.
Well, that was Esau didn't look ahead. Jacob was looking ahead.
Okay. Right. What else? Esau did not look ahead. Yeah.
Whenever I visualize this picture of this hungry man going to his brother and saying, "Give me some food," and Jacob refusing except laying down his deal, I always feel so angry with Jacob.
You feel angry with Jacob? Why angry with Jacob?
If I was a mother, it would be like, what?
Yeah.
It just... you know, I think the business about the favored younger one that most bothers me is that...
Is that Diane? I'm getting a glare, but that's why I had to ask. Welcome, first of all. But secondly, it's like you have a halo around you. Go ahead.
Well, this tradition of the younger one being favored, I think the thing that most bothers me about it is... It's accompanied with the history of the younger one doing rotten things and being loved. And even though Esau, you know, doesn't cherish what's important, it's also Jacob's own action taking advantage of the vulnerability of his brother
Yeah. Yeah, keep on going. Good. Good. Neither one are totally likable, are they?
No.
But you see, one, I have a friend of mine who, a respected colleague, who says, you read Genesis, and you are reading the record of one dysfunctional family. Yeah. Now, if you want to look at it that way, you can look at it that way, of course. I'm not sure that's very helpful. Because I think this family has in it the things that a lot of families have. I think that's what's helpful, to see what is in these stories that can help us, just as you and your brother, you know, can work out, maybe talking about some of these stories can help brother and brother deal with one another and understand this is nothing new. We're not experiencing anything that people haven't had for thousands of years. But neither one of these brothers, you can't say one brother's a great guy and one brother's a louse. Can you do that here?
Well, they're both
lice, huh? Well, I feel sort of sorry for both of them. They're trapped. They're trapped in history. They're trapped in something that somehow or other is bigger than both of them are. And what I'm interested in is what comes out of their struggle. The where and the here. Where? Where is what God asked Cain after he's killed Abel? And the here is what these brothers are trying to resolve with one another. Now, if I may just take one more minute before we read a little more, I want to point out to you that their rabbinic tradition, because Esau becomes Rome, has to make Esau more evil than he is. Has to do that. How do they do that? Hith rotzitzu habanim bekirba. The children wrestled within her. Rots is the rut, means to run or to wrestle. It rotzatsu abanim. The children wrestle. So, one tradition says, Jacob was calm and gentle, and his brother wanted to wrestle with him. And he wrestled so violently that his mother could have no more children afterwards. He hurt her womb. He wrestled. Okay? Wrestled. Inside while she was pregnant. That's what the coming in that one word. The children wrestled to come out. See? So that therefore Rebecca could have no more children after this wrestling. Second commentary. The children wrestled within her. When their mother, while she was pregnant, would pass a house of idolatry, Esau struggled to come out, wrestled. And when she passed a synagogue, Jacob wrestled. How's that? There were no synagogues in those days, of course. But in the tradition, Jacob sought to wrestle out himself out when they passed a holy place. The birthright, the stealing of the birthright. Esau wasn't really entitled to the birthright because of his moral conduct. The Bible says that Esau was a man of the field. Now, if I brought my little sheet of Midrash, I decided I didn't want to bring it today, I would show you how the Midrash would start talking about somebody being in the field and committing a crime from the book of 2 Chronicles. And from that, the Midrashist assumes that when the Genesis says Esau was in the field, that the parallel of the man of crime in the field tells us what kind of a person Esau was, which means Esau was out in the field committing crimes. Esau was a criminal. So therefore, he wasn't entitled to the birthright.
So was Cain out in the field.
Cain was out in the field, right. And the Midrash does draw that parallel.
Thank you.
You see, thank you, that's very good. From an obscure passage somewhere else about somebody being in the field committing a crime, they would apply, whenever they hear somebody in the field that they don't like, therefore they were in the field. Be careful going into the fields, guys. Fields landing, don't stop there. Do not land. What is it? Fields Point Landing, isn't that it? Yes, right, see, I remember. The third thing, Jacob was really entitled to the birthright. Jacob was really the firstborn, not the secondborn, okay? How in the world could you get that out of this text? How can you get the fact that Jacob was the firstborn out of the text that we've just read? No way, can you? Well, our rabbis found a way. They sure did find it. Anyone want to guess what it was? It has to do with what?
He had a hold of Esau's heel.
Well, that's very good. He had a hold of Esau's heel. Incidentally, I want to tell you. Do you know what Jacob means? It means he. Yaakov is he who heals. He who heel, grabs the heel. Yaakov means a heel. Ekev is a heel. Ekev is a heel. And you turn it into a verb, Yaakov is he who grabs the heel. Right. How would you like to go around life being called a heel? Some of my friends I call. Don't like it very much. Well, but yeah, go ahead. Anybody else know how Jacob would be first? You see, I'm not sure that would make Jacob first because he grabbed the heel.
Who was in charge?
Oh, okay, good. I like that. Yeah. Who was in charge? Jacob was, by holding on, he was in charge. Okay, that wasn't it, but I like that very much. I'll use that. I'll use that next Chamisha Asar Bishvat when I go. Last night when we were asking about our favorite holidays, I said Passover. That was a conformist answer. Again, I'm confessing. I really wanted to say Chamisha Asar Bishvat because I love to pronounce it. Love to pronounce it. Chamisha Asar Bishvat is the 15th day of the month of Shavat. Interesting, this is. Little digression. I told you at the beginning of these sessions that Hebrew letters of the alphabet are numbers. Yud is 10 and He is 5, so that's 15. Now, Chamisha Asar Bishvat is the 15th of Shavat, but of the month of Shavat. It's our Arbor Day. It's when we take the kids out and plant trees. Wonderful holiday. Planting trees is a marvelous holiday. I didn't say it last night because I wasn't sure I could get through the whole sentence with one breath. Chamisha Asar Bishvat is a big mouthful. But Chamisha Asar is 15th of Shavat. Yud He is 15th. But Yud He, if you were to write it, is an abbreviation for the name of God, Yahweh, Yud He. So you don't say Yud He Bishvat. You say Chamisha Asar 9 and 6. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, 10. I'm sorry. 10 and Chamisha is 5. Asar is 10, 5 and 10, that way, Chamisha Asar Bishvat. Okay? Now, get back to the question. How would the tradition explain why Jacob deserved to be first? Anybody else have an answer? Science. Take a test tube. Put two pearls in. The first pearl in is the last one out. Okay, think about it. Jacob deserved the birthright. The first in, the second out. Okay.
Right.
Some rabbi whose name deservedly forgotten to history.
That wanted to bring into question the right of the firstborn. I mean, was there some political stuff that was parallel to this story, and that this story was perhaps one of those stories that was saying, but the secondborn does have some rights.
I don't know of anything. It's a good question. I don't know of anything in history that would mandate the second son being favored over the firstborn son. Primogeniture, of course, is an important principle of the Bible. The firstborn is the one who inherits. So the question would be, is the firstborn worthy of inheriting? But I don't know of anything in history that would want to disinherit the firstborn son.
Well, except that I was thinking that perhaps it was something that would give parents a right to make a choice as to who inherited, rather than it be established. I mean, if the parents determined that the firstborn didn't deserve it.
Yeah. I'm thinking of the story of Zelophehad's daughters, which is a story in which would be a story that would deal obliquely with the question you're raising. And that is where the daughters who argue with Moses about their right to inherit their father's estate when there is no son. There's no son. You remember the story of Zelophehad? Well, that's like Chamishasar Bishvat this morning. Zelophehad's daughters. And there is nothing I know of that would question the right of the firstborn. In fact, it's over and over again repeated. But these stories that we're talking about certainly make that right a very questionable right. Other comments or questions? Let's read of the deception. Chapter 27, please. Verse 1. Go ahead, somebody read, 27.
When Isaac was old and his eyes were so weak that he could no longer see, he called for Esau, his older son, and said to him, "My son, here I am," he answered. Isaac said, "I am now an old man and don't know the day of my death. Now then, get your weapons, your quiver and bow, and go out to the open country to hunt some wild game for me. Prepare me the kind of tasty food I like, and bring it to me to eat so that I may give you my blessing before I die." Now Rebekah was listening as Isaac spoke to his son Esau. When Esau left for the open country to hunt game and bring it back, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, "Look, I overheard your father say to your brother Esau, 'Bring me some game and prepare me some tasty food to eat so that I may give you my blessing in the presence of the Lord before I die.' Now, my son, listen carefully and do what I tell you. Go out to the flock and bring me two choice young goats so I can prepare some tasty food for your father, just the way he likes it. Then take it to your father to eat so that he may give you his blessing before he dies." Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother, "But my brother Esau is a hairy man, and I'm a man with smooth skin. What if my father touches me? I would appear to be tricking him and would bring down a curse on myself rather than a blessing." His mother said to him, "My son, let the curse fall on me. Just do what I say. Go and get them for me." So he went and got them and brought them to his mother, and she prepared some tasty food, just the way his father liked it. When Rebekah took the best clothes of Esau, her older son, which she had in the house, and put them on her younger son Jacob, she also covered his hands and the smooth part of his neck with the goatskins. Then she handed to her son Jacob the tasty food and the bread she had made. He went to his father and said, "My father." "Yes, my son," he answered. "Who is it?" Jacob said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you told me. Please sit up and eat some of my game so that you may give me your blessing."
Okay, that's enough. Jacob, with the help of his mother here, deceives his father once again. And not only that, lies. He says, "I'm your son Esau." And he puts skins on his hands to receive the blessing. Now, our time is limited, so you will forgive me, please. Are there comments? Does anyone want to say anything before I... Yes?
One quick thing. Did Rebecca know about the deal prior to, between the brothers of selling the birthright?
That's a good question, and I don't know whether she knew. The Bible doesn't say. But remember, Esau has sold his birthright, and yet, despite that, Jacob has to say, "I'm Esau." Not only does he deceive his father, but he says, "I am Esau." He actually says, "I am Esau." So here are a couple of things that are interesting. Jacob deceives his father. His sons deceive Jacob. They say Joseph has been killed. How interesting the parallels. Jacob fools his father, and he in turn is fooled by his own children in the cruelest of ways. For years, he believes that his son has been killed. Notice the parallels. Jacob has to flee. In the earlier hour, I talked about that beautiful encounter. I love it, between Jacob and Laban, his father-in-law and his cousin. Laban marries his two daughters off to Jacob. Leah first, the weak-eyed one, and then Rebecca. Jacob works for 20 years. But what has precipitated all of this is the death of Isaac. When Isaac dies, Jacob has to flee. Flees. He's afraid of his brother again. He has to flee. He runs away. Lives way far away from Israel. Are you aware of how much of this whole first five books of the Bible, the constant promise is, thus Israel is the land, the promised land, the land of milk and honey. It's the land that God takes Abraham to, and yet most of the action takes place away from Israel. Very little of it takes place there. Abraham spends a few years of his life there. Most of the time he's fleeing somewhere and going off to pawn his wife off as his sister. Jacob has to run away from home and ends up down in Egypt, where whole four books of the Bible take place, down in Egypt. Jacob has to flee. He goes to the land of his relatives back in Nahor, up in the Fertile Crescent. Mary settles down and has this labor relations conflict. It's if you want to read something that's relevant to modern labor conflict, where Jacob is breeding the flocks for his father, and at the end of the term, he says to his father, "Let me go." And his father says, "Why, you know, you're stealing from me." And Jacob says to his father, "I've worked for you for 20 years. I've worked in the hot sun and in the cold weather. I've stayed out. I haven't cheated you. You've changed my wages 10 times. I can see a modern labor negotiation going on in this process. It's marvelous." And Jacob says, and Laban says to his cousin and his son-in-law, he says, "Look, You've cheated me. You've taken my flocks. You see, these wives are my wives. This flocks are my flocks. Everything you see is mine, says Laban. It's a classic labor versus management conflict, which you ought to read. Well, now Jacob comes back. And he's going to meet this brother. They're going to get together. The brother that he's had so much trouble with. And what does he do? He becomes Adam II all of a sudden. He divides up. Is that for us?
That's a 10 o'clock coffee break.
Ask not for whom the bell tolls. Oh.
It's too early.
Can I have 3 more minutes, okay? 3 more minutes. Divides up the flock. He gives stuff away. All of a sudden he says, I'm going to divide myself into two camps. He's dividing up now. He's not accumulating. He's giving up. And what does he do? In the middle of the night, all alone, he meets an angel. And he wrestles with the angel all night long. Wrestles with the angel. And the angel says to him, at the end of this night, your name shall no longer be Jacob. It shall be Yisrael, the one who has wrestled with the angel, the one who has wrestled with God. Yisrael, El, God. Yisrael wrestled. He wrestles with Israel. Jacob becomes Israel. Now, we could spend a whole day on Joseph, but Joseph at the end gives us the answer. Joseph has been sold into slavery. His father's been deceived. He's in Egypt. He deceives his own brother. He does to his brothers what his father did, you know, pretends he's somebody else, puts the younger brother in jail. And at the end of the story, and here's where we end, Joseph finally looks at his brothers and he says to them, I'm your brother Joseph. Here I am. I'm your brother Joseph. Where? That's the first question. In Genesis, here I am. That's the answer. Thank you all very much.